HPPodCraft.com.
Suddenly, with a single bound, he leapt into the room, winning a way past us before any of us could raise a hand to stay him. There was something so panther-like in the movement, something so unhuman, that it seemed to sober us all from the shock of his coming. The first to act was Harker, who, with a quick movement, threw himself before the door leading into the room in the front of the house. As the Count saw us, a horrible sort of snarl passed over his face, showing the eye teeth long and pointed. But the evil smile as quickly passed into a cold stare of lion-like disdain. His expression again changed as, with a single impulse, we all advanced upon him. It was a pity that we had not some better organized plan of attack, for even at the moment I wondered what we were to do. I did not myself know whether our lethal weapons would avail us anything. Harker evidently meant to try the matter, for he had ready his great kukri knife and made a fierce and sudden cut at him. The blow was a powerful one, only the diabolical quickness of the Count's leap back saved him. A second less and the trenchant blade had shorn through his heart. As it was, the point just cut the cloth of his coat, making a wide gap whence a bundle of banknotes and a stream of gold fell out. The expression of the Count's face was so hellish that for a moment I feared for Harker, though I saw him throw the terrible knife aloft again for another stroke. Instinctively, I moved forward with a protective impulse, holding the crucifix and wafer in my left hand. I felt a mighty power fly along my arm, and it was without surprise that I saw the monster cower back before a similar movement made spontaneously by each one of us. It would be impossible to describe the expression of hate and baffled malignity, of anger and hellish rage which came over the Count's face. His waxen hue became greenish-yellow by the contrast of his burning eyes, and the red scar on the forehead showed on the pallid skin like a palpitating wound. The next instant, with a sinuous dive, he swept under Harker's arm ere his blow could fall, and grasping a handful of the money from the floor, dashed across the room, threw himself at the window. Amid the crash and glitter of the falling glass, he tumbled into the flagged area below. Through the sound of the shivering glass, I could hear the ting of the gold as some of the sovereigns fell on the flagging.
That was an excerpt from Dr. Seward's journal recounting a knife fight with that old money-grabbing Dracula. We have been covering Dracula, the novel, all month, and we're in the 23rd chapter, and this is the 250th episode.
Unbelievable.
Of the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At HPPodCraft.com, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
Chad, that is 1/4 of 1,000.
I would never have guessed that we'd be 250 episodes into this thing, but here we are. And our reader, once again, if you didn't notice at the top, was Andrew Lehman. Wanted to quickly note that Andrew's appearing in a new show at Theater Banshee in Burbank. So if you're in the L.A. area, highly recommend checking it out. The show is Mine Eyes Hath Seen, an evening of first-person pieces written by people who lived through the Civil War. It opens March 28th and runs until May 17th with a special performance on April 9th, marking the 150th anniversary of the surrender at Appomattox. Lehman will actually be doing the Gettysburg Address in this thing. So if you're a Lehman fan, you should go check it out. You've seen it, actually, haven't you?
Yeah, of course I've seen it. Not recently. I saw it when they first did it a few years ago. Maybe it was 6 years ago, 7 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. It's really outstanding. All of the stuff is letters and accounts from people that were actually in the war. So it doesn't get much better than that.
It doesn't. And this week, to conclude this novel, we are joined by a new guest.
That's right. We're happy to have John Rippian on the show.
Hello, guys.
Hi, glad to have you.
John and his wife, Leah Moore, are authors of The Complete Dracula, a comic book adaptation of the novel, illustrated by Colton Worley.
It's complete, you know, none of these half Draculas. We wanted to do the whole thing. Years ago, we were writing for a company called Dynamite, and they asked us what we thought about doing something with Dracula. And just to basically make our lives a lot harder, we thought that instead of doing kind of Sherlock Holmes versus Dracula or something like that, we'd try and do a 100% or 110% faithful adaptation of the Stoker's book into a graphic novel. So we kind of went back to Stoker's notes and put some stuff in that had been cut out.
Like Dracula's Guest.
Which I know is a little bit controversial whether that should be part of it.
Oh, it is. The fact that it got edited, sure, that means that it shouldn't be in there because, like, obviously they made a decision not to include it. However, it was intended at one point to be part of that story. So, yeah, of course. I say put it in. And it's cool.
It's kind of like a director's cut thing, isn't it? And it's also that we're all kind of so familiar with Dracula, especially that first bit of Dracula, those first chapters. I think it's good to be able to surprise people with something different to get them into the whole story. So yeah, that was a really fun thing to do. It came out a few years back now, and we just went mad with the research on it. Got really, really into the book.
Yeah, I have to say, though, one of the things I do really appreciate about the book is that Dracula has a mustache.
You've got to put the mustache in there. It's got to be.
One of the things I think you were talking about, either you wrote me or it was on Twitter, I don't remember, John, about the beard. You said that you thought that Dracula was the coachman and he shaved his beard.
Yeah.
And then came back as the count.
I don't think that's any less ridiculous than him wearing a false beard, which is what people seem to think might have happened. Yeah, I think that he's been kind of alone in the castle for a long time, so he's probably got a big long beard and long hair, and then he kind of smartens himself up to meet Harker, mistakenly thinking that everybody in Britain has a big mustache because he's kind of
behind the times.
Yeah, just a little bit behind the times.
When he gets to England, he has a beard again when he's younger.
Yeah, like a goatee beard, yeah.
Is that part of his, in your opinion, of course, is that part of his supernatural powers, forcing out a beard?
Yeah, you know where I sit with that. I think he can just make any kind of facial hair material.
How does he do that?
Same way he turns into a dog or a bat.
No. Like, tell me, what does he do?
Oh, he goes like, Van Dyke, you know. He has to call out what it is. Friendly mutton chops. Hey, I just wanted to get one more plug in before we dive back into this. And I'll make a bigger deal out of it next week on our free show, because this has mostly been just announced to the backers so far. But if you'll recall, I did a soundtrack for a Chaosium's 7th edition of The Call of Cthulhu.
Oh, right, yeah. I've heard it. It kicks ass.
Thank you. The full hour of music. It's called Sense Impacts. I have just been informed it is now available for download on their site. So we'll put a link up to it. You can go over there and buy it if you didn't, in fact, back the Kickstarter. New music available. It's all brand new. You haven't heard it before. I haven't even played it on the show before because, you know, I couldn't. But I'm going to start playing it on the show next couple of weeks so that people can get a taste of it. If they like it, go pick it up.
Yeah.
Where we are so far.
Where we are so far. Now, we kind of jumped around a little bit at the end of the last episode, but Dracula made Mina drink his blood, so she is under his spell, sort of, but not too much, kind of.
Yeah.
But the guys, they're all out trying to hunt down Dracula's boxes of earth because they figure once they consecrate those, he can't use them. And if they get all of them, that will defeat Dracula somehow. Again, we're not exactly sure what that means to Dracula if all of his earth gets consecrated. Does that mean he dies? Does that mean he's powerless? Does that mean he turns into a unicorn? We don't know. That bit that Andrew read at the top there was a confrontation. One of the places they went to, Dracula was actually physically there, but it was during the day, so he didn't have his crazy supernatural powers. He was still pretty tough, man. He was moving really fast, dodging knife fights like a jet. He was awesome.
Like a jet? You mean like the...
Yeah, like the...
Like the West Side Story,
exactly.
Gang. Boy, it took me a second to understand what you meant.
And he jumps out the window, running off with some of his money.
It's a very undignified escape for Dracula, grabbing his coins up off the ground as he's running away. Yeah. But he does leave and do some boasting to them, right? And he says, you know, you think to baffle me, your pale face is all in a row. I like it when he says, your girls that you all love are mine already. That's my favorite line there. Your girls that you all love are mine already. It's weird and strangely, and it's just a total like, I'm sleeping with your sister, yo. You might be kicking me out of this party, but I had some of that, you know.
You're right. It is really undignified. It's basically the bit where the tables do turn, and he only kind of turns around and says all this once he's already fallen out of a window. He suddenly doesn't seem like such an evil force to be dealt with, does he? Kind of. He seems a lot more fallible all of a sudden, and even though he does do this cool big speech, my revenge has just begun, it will be spread over centuries, and you know, all of that, which is really good big talk, he is still just running off down some back alley at the end of it, so.
Right, he's still got a bunch of money stuffed into his shirt. Coins falling.
That's all he can do right now, because if it's during the day and he doesn't have any power during the day, so if it was at night, he would have just killed them all.
Yeah,
or made them his slaves or done more horrible things. Unfortunately, at this point, you're right, John, he's just totally powerless, and so all they can do is talk.
No, speaking of hair, this is something that never occurred to me until this reading. Probably I wasn't reading it very closely, but Jonathan Harker, his hair has turned white.
That's after the whole thing with Mina being forced to drink the blood, isn't it? And you see it as the sun comes up over the asylum. Is that where they are, the asylum, when that happens?
Yeah.
Yeah, which always just makes me think of Evil Dead 2. the sun is coming up, then he's that white streak is kind of ripping through the side of his hair.
Absolutely. I had the exact same thought.
I mean, that scene is so horrible. Like, he was there. I mean, we talked about it last week, but he was there and had to watch it going on. He was paralyzed by Dracula's mind power to watch him do this despicable thing to his wife right in front of him. If anything turns a guy's hair white.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Everybody's written records and diaries and everything. The stuff that goes on between Mina and Dracula and with Jonathan there is so weird. You do kind of wonder what has gone unsaid, like how much of it is exactly what happened and how much of it is just what they can bear to put down, because the whole thing is, I think he says like about the forcing their face into him like a kitten being forced to drink from a saucer of milk or something. Yeah. There's some really weird, unpleasant language in the whole thing. So there's kind of, I don't even know if it's a subtext or whether it's a thing where they haven't been able to bring themselves to put down what actually happened.
We touched on it a bit last week, but the implication might be that it was an actual rape that was going on.
Yeah.
But being that it was a Victorian time, they wouldn't directly write that. It was just supposed to be implied.
Yeah. And I think it's weirder and creepier the way it's done in the book. We all pick up on how strangely worded it is and what an unpleasant scene it is. And I think that probably it works better than if it was, you know, kind of completely overt.
And I remember reading it for the first time. I was familiar with Dracula from the movies as a kid, and that scene's never in them, really. Well, the ones that I had seen, and so it surprised me that he was doing it. The way he's holding her arms in one hand.
Oh, yeah. It's very violent.
I mean, even if it's taken at face value, I think it still constitutes a rape, considering what he makes her do.
Sure.
They manage to consecrate all the boxes of earth at Carfax, and then they get to this Piccadilly place where they encounter him. They manage to ruin those boxes. They know that he's got one box left.
One left, that's right.
But they don't know where it is. The first half of the novel is a mystery. It's an act of discovery.
Yes.
The game of it is that something awful is happening and we're not quite sure what it is. When we hit the midpoint, then it becomes a couple of thriller-type games. The first one is there are all these boxes and we need to get to them before he gets to them. And what is his counter-planning going on? And then the game after that, after they've accomplished most of that goal, is a chase. Now he's got a box and he's going somewhere. We need to figure out where it is, even though we don't have a distinct idea of it. Jonathan notes in his journal of October 3rd and 4th that Dracula just hid with this box somewhere for decades.
Yeah.
They might never get him.
He could just wait it out for, you know, 50 years.
Yeah, he could just wait for them all to be dead, and they're lucky that he decides to run. Although if he was hiding in England because he's a foreigner and doesn't exactly know what he's doing, there's also risk that they would eventually discover him because they wouldn't stop looking.
Yeah, now this is the point where they're not sure where the heck they're going to find Dracula, because they're just, it's like a needle in a haystack. But then Van Helsing gets this idea. He's like, wait a minute. They're connected in some way, and he's got some kind of mind power over her. I do this little thing called hypnosis. You might have heard of it before.
Well, they discussed it earlier in the book, and don't take credit away from Mina, because this is actually her idea.
So that she may speak freely, that's what it says, isn't it? It's strange that she kind of has this idea, because does that mean that maybe she's already sensing stuff, maybe about Dracula, and she wants to, when she says speak freely, it always makes me think like that he's blocking her from telling them somehow, or
yeah,
there's definitely something more to it than just like, oh, I've had an idea, just hypnotize me. There's definitely something else going on.
Yeah, I think that Mina feels that she's sort of under his control, except on those moments of Dracula's weakness at the sunset and sunrise. That's when she wants Van Helsing to hypnotize her. And when he does, she kind of switches place with him and feels the sensory sensations that he's getting. So she knows that it's dark. She hears water, so it's some sort of ship, but that the ship's anchor is still down.
Because she can hear like sounds of other boats and things.
She can tell she's in a harbor. Now that they've got this way to clue into where he's at, the investigation begins to figure out where Dracula's going. They have a meeting to kind of discuss the best way to track him down. They guess that he's going to be heading back to Transylvania, since that's where his base of power is. So they look for any ships that might be headed in that direction. After asking around, they figure out there's this ship, the Tsarina Catherine, which is headed that direction. Unfortunately, it's already sailed.
But they happen to know the ship's schedule and its destination. So hopefully they're going to be able to beat Dracula there by taking the train across Europe. A little action on the Orient Express.
There is the cool detail that when they find out about him, the suspicious figure getting the box onto the ship, about him wearing the outmoded hat.
Oh, right, yeah.
When we were doing the complete Dracula, we actually left that out deliberately. There's kind of notes in the back and we say we've left that out deliberately because we're doing it as a visual thing. You're reading Dracula as a text document. Works fine as the text document. As soon as we have to show Dracula with a funny straw hat on, It's kind of, he's not frightening anymore. That's it. You've blown the whole thing.
Do you think it's, God, how did I forget that? That made me laugh when I was reading it because I was thinking it's one of these big straw hats you'd get in Tijuana or something like that.
A sombrero?
A sombrero, but these specific ones made of straw that have like beer advertisements on them and stuff like that. I mean, is he doing it to keep the sun off of him?
Maybe. That's the way I pictured it. It's like it was a big sun hat.
Don't laugh at me. I'm a vampire. I've got to wear a big hat. You think it's funny? I've got problems.
If I ever get the chance to play Dracula, I'm going to seize on that detail and wear the straw hat throughout and just be like, this is my take on the man. Now, at this point, again, they have to keep Mina in the dark about what they're doing, because even though she's able to give them clues to Dracula's location during his weak moments, dusk and sunrise,
she could feed him information, and he's got control over her, so he can just kind of, well, they don't know, but they think that he might be able to suck it out of her.
Well, Jonathan, you know, he's been making out with her, and he's like, she's kind of making out like a man.
That is not in the book.
That's in my book. That's in Ken Height's unredacted version of it. Anyway, Mina is on board with this. Don't tell me anything about your plans to go after Dracula, because he'll find out by getting into my brain. Jonathan's upset, but he promises that they won't do that. Now, before everybody goes, Van Helsing asks that they all tie up their will. I mean, these people are ready to go to the death against the Count. They all have to make their wills, tie up all their affairs. They know this could go badly for them. Mina makes them all promise that if things go bad for her, if she turns into a vampire, that they'll kill her. And they have this scene where they basically have a funeral for her, right? I mean, they say a burial service for her while she's still alive.
Yeah.
She's afraid that once she's corrupted, that her soul might be taken away from her. So she wants the last rites and things while she's still alive.
My pact would be totally different. I'd say in my pact, you all promise to be my vampire servants, right? If things go bad, let's just see how the other side lives. What do you say? Just to cut to the chase, in order to get all the information they need about the Serena Catherine, they do a lot of bribery. I think Jonathan Harker says, Judge Moneybag will settle this case, I think. Which I thought was a great phrase.
That's a good one. Anyway, they go ahead, travel via train. They have some problems on the train journey. There's like some malfunctions and there's an accident, I think, further up the line. It has nothing to do with Dracula, but it holds them up a bit and they have to make up lost time. Unfortunately, being held up has caused them some problems, so Dracula has been able to kind of take advantage of the situation a bit.
He's already arranged for the box to be collected and then passed on to another man, and then that second man's already been killed. And they're actually there when then the guy's body's discovered, aren't they? So they're not very far behind him, hot on his trail. But I mean, this is all basically because everything has sped up massively suddenly in the book. Is like you say, it's gone into this chase sequence. All these little setbacks where he's thought to plan ahead with this, it suddenly moves at quite a modern pace, which the rest of the book really doesn't. You know, everything happens six times before anybody notices it's happened.
Yeah.
And then you get into this final quarter and it's as full on as Dracula gets, sort of thing. So these are really cool, these little misdirections. And
well, everything is an antithesis to the beginning of the book in a lot of ways. Especially, I love that the ship's captain's like, man, what a great trip.
Yeah, went off without a hitch, no problems.
It's almost weird how good it went, you know, and I think, you know, that's amusing considering how it went on the trip over. And as you say, everything speeds up a lot faster. We don't have to belabor anything. We're just going at this point.
That's also because of how fast they're traveling. And there's all this cool stuff where Mina said, you know, oh, I'm a bit of a train fiend. I know, I happen to look up when this train's going to be. I'm in a little bit, there's kind of the, we'll go by steamboat because steam is faster than oars. And this is all the modernity of the Victorians against Dracula. All of a sudden, it's ludicrous how slowly he's traveling and the way he's having to travel. And they're just like, we'll just get a cab, pretty much, you know, which is how they're able to keep up with him so well. So you've got to throw these spanners in the works, I think. Otherwise, they would just be, well, it would have been that they would have just caught him when he got off the boat, and that would have been the end of the book. And it so nearly is the end of the book. You know, it's a good false ending. Everything is building up to that, and then he just gets away and they have to pursue him again, so it's cool.
They split up in order to best pursue him. Arthur and Jonathan take a steamboat down the river where his body's being transported. Quincy and Dr. Stewart go along the shore on horseback. And then Mina and Van Helsing go by carriage to Castle Dracula itself. They hope that they get Dracula before he gets as close as he does to his castle. That's why Mina and Van Helsing are planted there.
When they break up, I mean, we focus mostly a lot on Van Helsing and Mina. The guys are just running around, so that's kind of boring. But Van Helsing's doing some, like, wizard stuff at this point. He, like, makes this magic circle to protect Mina and him from any of the bad stuff that's around out there.
This is all the vampire lore that he has known from the start and didn't want to reveal it to everybody until he was sure that was what was going on, isn't it? Van Helsing's very suspicious from early on. The way I read the book is very much that he kind of has some women issues. And there is the whole thing of him burning her head with the wafer, which is kind of really weird and quite violent. And that's very definitely to mark her, isn't it? That's to say, you know, nobody forget she has been bitten by Dracula. She is not one of us anymore.
You think that was intentional that he did? I thought he was just kind of blessing her, and then he was surprised that it actually burned her.
Well, it's difficult to believe that he wouldn't know it would, given how knowledgeable he is with everything else, you know, about using the wafer to seal the tombs. And he's shown such good knowledge of every aspect of it that suddenly doing that and going, oh, whoops, just kind of comes across a little bit. It makes sense for him to want to mark her as well, in as much as he wants to say to people, don't forget she is going to be dangerous from now on. But she's only dangerous from now on because he excluded her from everything all along and wouldn't listen to anything she said. He's very suspicious of her as they're traveling along. And then there's that cool moment where he says he's watching her in the, it is when he's in the protective circle, isn't it? And he's watching her by the firelight. He dozes off. And when he wakes up, he says she's just staring at him, which is just cool. You know, it's just a little tiny thing, but that's just where you sort of think, oh, right, she's gone now, hasn't she? She's not quite right.
And then when the three brides show up, the three vampire women that try and lure Mina out of the circle.
Yeah, they go all Lost Boys on Mina. And the thing with that, now Dracula had cut her off at some point when he realized they were using her to track his movements. He sort of severed the psychic link. But she is definitely still under his power, or at least she's becoming different. She's staring at Van Helsing while he sleeps. If it weren't for that circle, one guesses that she might go join the sisters. Maybe when that scar fades later and she's cured after Dracula's death, maybe he just, we talked about this a bit, maybe he just let her go. If he indeed faked his own death, which we keep trying to push. After the evening in which the three women tease and approach Van Helsing and Mina, the next day he leaves her in the protective circle and he goes into the castle by himself to take care of these ladies.
But when he gets there, he's, you know, all ready to kill him and stuff, but he's like, man, they're really good looking.
Yeah, they are so hot. He gets a little entranced by the first one when he opens the box. He just can't stop looking at her. He goes into a sort of trance.
He decided not to kill Lucy himself because he wanted to demonstrate. He wanted to prove to everybody about the vampire thing, but this is what would have happened to Lucy. Just goes in and kills three vampires, three women vampires on his own, which is pretty hardcore. And he's not just this kind of old man mouthing off. He can take care of business when he needs to, even if there are some issues about exactly why he wants to do these things and everything, then he can go through with it.
Yeah, there's no point either. Does he consider maybe if he gets rid of Dracula that these women might go back to normal?
Well, he knows better than that, doesn't he?
He doesn't. No, what do you mean he knows better than that? He throws out all this stuff throughout the whole flipping book where he's like, this is exactly the way it is. And then maybe it isn't that way. Maybe it's not. He's just, you know, he's read it in a book somewhere. So that makes it true.
Well, so that gets down to it, his backstory, which we don't really know. Has he actually encountered vampires and dealt with them in his past? Or is this all book learning?
Yeah, I suppose it makes sense that he has encountered them before because of how matter of fact he is with his big bag full of vampire killing equipment. It's pretty on the case.
After he's destroyed the women, he comes back out. He's hanging out with Mina. It doesn't take too long. I think it's another day till they begin to see the convergence of their teammates.
Yes.
In pursuit of the wagon that contains the box of earth that contains Dracula.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, it's the gypsy guys, this Zagani.
And this is the big raging climax of the novel. This is rarely something that you would see done in the films. I know that they did a version of this in the Coppola movie. Other than that, I don't think I've seen this chase happen very often.
It's watched from a distance as well. They're watching it through the binoculars and it's only the other parties can't see each other and they're seeing it all coming together, which is, you know, really cool and really dramatic. Sort of, are they going to get to him in time? And the sun is just beginning to set as a wagon is racing along with the coffin in the back and everything. So it's good stuff.
So why don't the gypsies just pull over, hide Dracula's body out in the woods, and then keep going, become a distraction until nightfall?
But I don't think they knew until it was too late that they were being pursued the way that they're being pursued.
Oh.
And to stop would be defeat because the horsemen, and they would catch up with them.
Right.
And they would destroy the body. So they're just trying to get as close as they can to Dracula's center of power.
Right.
You know, before the night does come. And I think that him waking up is the ticking, you know, as John says, is there's a time crunch here. We know that Dracula's going to wake up very shortly, so it's a great set piece in that respect. There's this clock ticking down. They'd better get it done quickly. But when they do finally catch up, and along those lines, the Scani aren't that dedicated to Dracula either, because as soon as they catch up with their rifles, they sort of give up.
No! What are you talking about? It's a knife fight, man. They freaking pull out some knives and start fighting. Freaking Quincy gets stabbed.
Oh, that's true.
And then they pull out their guns and then they go, okay, we give up at that point.
You're right. There is a tussle there because that's when Quincy catches it in the side.
One of those things that I wondered about is why didn't they just pull out their Winchesters immediately? They don't. They just jump. The knife fights happen. Quincy loses. Then they pull out the Winchesters, which I didn't quite understand.
This is kind of the old world, new world thing. I mean, it doesn't really make sense in terms of the fight, but it's the same thing again where they're going, oh, you know, we've got Bradshaw's guide for the train times. We've got, it's all right, we'll take a paddle steamer, we'll do this. And it's kind of where they go, well, we have knives. And then they go, haha, we have guns. You know, it's another kind of, oh, look at the technology kind of thing. But yeah, it would have been better to do that before Quincy was fatally stabbed, obviously.
But so, they do think to do it.
By this time, the gypsies, seeing themselves covered by the Winchesters and at the mercy of Lord Godalming and Dr. Seward, had given in and made no resistance. The sun was almost down on the mountain tops, and the shadows of the whole group fell long upon the snow. I saw the Count lying within the box upon the earth, some of which the rude falling from the cart had scattered over him. He was deathly pale, just like a waxen image, and the red eyes glared with the horrible vindictive look which I knew too well. As I looked, the eyes saw the sinking sun, and the look of hate in them turned to triumph. But on the instant came the sweep and flash of Jonathan's great knife. I shrieked as I saw it shear through the throat, whilst at the same moment Mr. Morris's Bowie knife plunged into the heart. It was like a miracle. But before our very eyes, and almost in the drawing of a breath, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. I shall be glad as long as I live that even in that moment of final disillusion, there was in the face a look of peace such as I never could have imagined might have rested there.
And that reading was from Mina's journal, and again we have my lovely, talented, and beautiful wife reading Rachel Lackey.
It's interesting that Mina says about the sense of peace on his face, and that goes back to earlier on where Jonathan is saying how much he basically just wants to kill Dracula and is only out for revenge, and she says there's a chance I might turn into a vampire and I don't want people to think of me that way as like a monster that needs killing. I want us to try and treat him with some kind of compassion, and obviously she has got compassion for him
right.
At the end to some degree, and you know, whether that is to do with the control that he's had over the connection they've had and whatever, or whether it is just because she's kind of a good, nice person, which is how she's been written throughout. She's the only kind of sane,
thoughtful,
yeah,
empathic.
Definitely.
She has sympathy for the devil.
The last bit is the note from Jonathan Harker where you kind of skip ahead 7 years later, and they've got a little boy who they've named Quincy. Well,
Quincy Van Helsing Arthur. He's got a big string of names, it says.
It's like all the guys' names are in there, but they call him Quincy primarily because I guess Quincy was the one that bit it, so he gets the primary name.
And of course Quincy has that moment when Dracula perishes, the mark on Mina's forehead goes away,
right?
Yeah,
as Quincy says, you know, it was worth it for this,
to see that mark lifted, to see that stain lifted from her. She's completely redeemed, and they've all done their job again, ignoring the fact that it was all of their fault that she had the mark on her head in the first place.
At the end of this, the 7 years later, they actually go back to Transylvania to kind of just, I don't know, make sure that everything is as it should be, I suppose.
To get those recipes.
Those paprika chicken recipes. Mm-hmm. And I remember we talked about this briefly in the novel. Originally, or in the manuscripts, the castle disintegrated and fell apart when Dracula died. But in this version, or the final version of it, the castle's still there.
I think we did it as more of an explosion than a dissolution. But it's kind of, you know, it's a big Hollywood ending to the whole thing. And that is supposed to be, supposedly, because it's kind of, it's only been his influence that has been holding the whole thing together, but also it's kind of erasing all trace of Dracula and what was going on. They say they go and basically there's nothing, that even if the castle's there, there's nothing kind of sinister there anymore. They're all happy that it's all been cleared up.
I think that it's somewhat like a viewing at a funeral or at a visitation, because if the castle had disintegrated and Dracula's body had disintegrated, I think it would be very difficult for this group to accept that he was really gone. But the fact that they can come back 7 years later, they don't see Dracula's body, but the castle is still there and it's not a scary place to be. This happened, we did it, we vanquished it, we were successful. It just brings home the truth of that for them. So I think that might be the purpose of it.
Yeah.
Better closure, isn't it? Otherwise it would be like nobody would believe that this had happened, and are we even sure this really did happen? Yeah, mm-hmm. There's, you know, which is a way to play it. But yeah, I can see that it's a much more concrete ending and much more everybody gets to say, yeah, that was all definitely sorted and we can all carry on now.
Well, I gotta say, it's one hell of a book. We could have spent weeks more on this thing. There's just so much to talk about, but I feel like that a month is plenty for Dracula.
It's more than most vampires get, to be honest. And yeah, it was fun to jump. I think we covered most of the fun parts. We rarely have grappled an entire novel on this show, or if we've had, they've been somewhat simplistic. This is a complex work of literature, so obviously we didn't get to all of the nuanced stuff. I want to thank Andrew for being with us the whole month and doing those readings, as well as Rachel Lackey for kicking some Mina ass.
And if you get a chance, go see Andrew in Mine Eyes Hast Seen over at Theater Banshee in Burbank.
And John, thank you for being our guest today. Did you have any final thoughts on Dracula? Anything you wanted?
I guess the final words of the book, Jonathan's little note there about his son. He says, later on, he will understand how some men who loved her so, this is about Mina, that they did dare much for her sake. Coming back to this whole thing of everybody all being part of the same gang, but also the final words of the book are kind of saying, oh, thank God we all saved Mina and we all did that for her and she must be very grateful and my son will know how grateful she is. And to my reading of the whole thing is that kind of misses the point of the book where Mina sorted everything out, told them what to do, kept all the notes. Once Dracula destroyed everything, she'd already copied it in triplicate. So
yeah,
even in the final words of the book, which are fantastic, it kind of emphasizes how much every man in the book has missed the point of how good Mina is, which, you know, Stoker clearly hadn't missed the point of that.
Right.
Stoker was doing that on purpose. So I think it's a really cool ending because it delivers on so many levels. It kind of shows like what Hark has been through and how much Hark has missed as well. So I just think it's a cool ending.
Man, you really hit the nail on the head.
Excellent insight, and it is indeed an excellent end of the book. I'm going to miss it.
We got something special planned for next week.
We'll be posting on the social networks and the website once we've decided on our next show.
Yep.
That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm John Repian.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.